one of the things that that did, I think in beef practice in general, we were already on a trajectory where we were doing less individual animal medicine. You know, we were moving more towards herd related stuff. And I think BSE really accelerated that. People were not spending any money on non-essential services. So that was certainly one of the biggest challenges, but we got through that.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lallemand Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandy Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, we're joined by Dr. Mike Jelinski, Managing Partner with Veterinary AgriHealth Services in Alberta, Canada, which is a six-person beef cattle practice focusing on cow-calf and feedlot production, research, and teaching. The practice received the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association Practice of the Year Award in 2015, and also a partner with Mosaic Veterinary Partners, which owns seven mixed animal practices located in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and three small animal practices in Calgary. In addition to management responsibilities, Dr. Jelinski takes an active interest in the field services and student teaching components of the practice and currently holds a clinical teaching appointment in the Faculty of Veterinary Medicine's Distributed Learning Community at the University of Calgary. Dr. Jelinski is a past recipient of the Boehringer Ingelheim Veterinarian of the Year Award from the Western Canadian Association of Bovine Practitioners, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his insight and experience from his long and storied career in beef cattle practice. I'm very excited to have him on the podcast today, so let's get to that. Dr. Jelinski, thank you so much for joining us here today and taking some time out of your schedule. You know, how are you?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be just referred to as Mike. I'm always fairly casual, so doing well today. It's a nice sunny day here in southern Alberta, so it's all good.
I would really, if you could send some of that sunny weather south to Kansas. I've been joking with my husband that in early January and like late December, that Canada's weather kind of escaped the backyard and made it down to my backyard. And so I would love some sunny days. It's foggy and a little bit rainy. And so I'm looking forward to the sun soon. To start off with, for those who maybe haven't heard much about you or your practice, could you just bring us up to speed on your background and how you got started in the beef industry and your career? I touched on a small portion of your career in the bio, but I know that there's more to it than that.
Yeah. So I'm a 1986 graduate of the Western College of Veterinary Medicine. I was actually raised in the city. I had lots of relatives that farmed nearby. I was raised in Regina, Saskatchewan, so the province next door. But I always had good mentors around me. And so when I was in university, I had the opportunity to work in a large animal practice just on weekends, just, you know, doing casual labor, and certainly got interested in the cattle industry from that. And so once I got into vet school, I became more interested in the first job. I guess it was after my second year of vet school, I took a job in Alberta for the summer, and I worked in a beef practice where they did a lot of embryo transfer and mostly cattle, and had really good mentors again. So I think once I had a taste of Alberta, I sort of knew that that's where I wanted to come back to. So after graduating, I did move to Alberta. I did a couple of years in mixed practice, and then I moved to a practice just north of Calgary where I did 5 years of large animal. And then in about 1993, there had been a new packing plant. Cargill had built the packing plant just south of Calgary in the late 80s. And the feedlot industry was really starting to expand in Alberta. And there was lots of little feedlots popping up, you know, 2,500 to 4,000 head yards that weren't necessarily getting the care they needed. And at least the type of practice I was interested in doing, more of a herd approach. So in 1993, I started Veterinary AgriHealth Services, and my goal was really just to sort of focus on sort of delivering, you know, more herd health-related type services as opposed, you know, I'd certainly done more than my share of middle of the night calvings and individual animal medicine, but I was interested in, you know, sort of the epidemiological approach. So I forged off and I was able to find some really good clients right from the beginning. Again, some really good mentors in the beef industry. Ed Miller from Highway 21 Feeders was one of my really good mentors, taught me lots about cattle markets and hedging and futures and all that. And then I just became more and more interested. So that was sort of what got me going in on the path I'm on today.
That's super interesting just to hear about. I mean, just you went to Calgary and you liked it, and then this career and things were popping up. It's just, I love hearing about people's origin story. I guess that's maybe, you know, what I'm getting at is how, you know, it started here and then the growth and the founding of the business. And maybe you can talk a little bit more about the evolution of your beef practice. I know you've mentioned a little bit how it started, but maybe some of the growing pains to get to this point. I'm sure over, you know, you mentioned you were in the industry, you've been in the industry for 40 years. I'm sure there's been some growing pains. It hasn't been all roses and daisies and things like that.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't a straight line to where we are today. I practiced on my own for 5 years from 1993 to 98. And then as I'd grown the practice enough that Dr. Craig Doran joined me. Craig graduated a year ahead of me and worked in both practice and industry. He joined me in 98 as the practice kept growing. And again, the feedlot industry was expanding. And it was just sort of a slow, steady, growing organically, never really doing any advertising, but word of mouth type growth. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the real first major stumbling block was BSE. So in 2003, as you may recall, or maybe not, that's when Canada found it, the first case of BSE. And so that, you know, that was May of 2003. And the gate was, you know, the border was slammed shut. And, you know, I was just refreshing my memory on some of that. That slaughter cattle went down to about 33 cents. It was a tough time, so much uncertainty. And so, you know, we were very fortunate at the time because the Alberta government was in a position financially to lend support. There was a number of programs that were rolled out to try to manage the supply because, of course, now Canada exports, you know, 40% roughly of our production goes to the U.S. and then some to other countries. So all of a sudden our doors were closed. All that production had to be consumed in Canada or else delayed with the anticipation that we'd get the borders open. So we were lucky to get box beef open by September. So there was some beef starting to flow again, you know, in September, but it was 2 full years before the live cattle markets reestablished. So, so that was a challenge. I mean, that was the summer of 2003. So Dr. Doran and I, we took a lot of holidays that summer. There wasn't, given we were just a 100% beef practice, there wasn't much happening. And I think one of the things that did, I think in beef practice in general, we were already on a trajectory where we were doing less individual animal medicine. You know, we were moving more towards herd-related stuff. And I think BSE really accelerated that. People were not spending any money on non-essential services. So that was certainly one of the biggest challenges. But we got through that. Our clients came through it. And then after that, you know, there's been other things. There's been some other trade issues across the border, but it always seems to get ironed out. And so over the period of time, we continued to grow. The vet school in Calgary opened, that's probably 15, 18 years ago. So we were quite involved with them and we still are today. We provide teaching rotations because they're just 20 minutes away from where we're located. So we're part of the distributed teaching hospital. And we take students 2 or 3 times a year and, you know, give clinical experience. And then we also started, we grew some more. We've got to where we are today, which is, I'd say, 5 full-time veterinarians plus me, which is more of a 3-day a week.
Yeah.
But we're also fairly involved in research, and I can touch on a little bit of that later. But between sort of our, you know, and our cow-calf practice is growing as well. So between the feedlot, cow-calf, our teaching roles and our research, it keeps us all pretty busy. And each, and we all get to sort of pick and choose what we enjoy doing.
Oh, that's wonderful that, you know, you get to specialize in the thing that maybe you have the biggest passion for. When you mentioned teaching and that you have veterinary students come and visit, like for their clinical things, their clinical experiences, I guess, I don't know the right word to use, but is that the teaching, is that the entirety of the teaching? Or I think you mentioned, or I read it in your bio, that you also teach at the university, at the veterinary hospital, is that, or at the veterinary school, like, is that correct? Do you also go and teach classes, or is it more just on the clinical basis, that experiential learning for those veterinary students?
Yeah, it's a clinical teaching appointment. So they come to us. Yeah, we, you know, we occasionally will give lectures in the city, but most of it is done, you know, when they come to see us. And we get students not just from Calgary, but the ones that we get from Calgary, those are actually credit rotations. So that's part of their curriculum. But we certainly get students from all over the U.S. We've had students from Australia, the U.K. come and visit for a week or two and just want to sort of see what we do. We have actually, about 8 years ago, we started what we call a more of a intensive beef cattle rotation that we put on in July. So in July, we take 10 students and we pick them, and we get usually three or four from the U.S., two or three from Eastern Canada, and then two or three from the West. And it's about 10 full days of full-on beef cattle production teaching. So we do, you know, genomics, genetics, nutrition, some feedlot work, you know, treatment protocols, processing protocols, kind of the A to Z of beef production. And that's, you know, we're in our eighth year, and that's become a quite a sought after rotation, because it is a credit rotation too for the students that take it.
I am not a veterinarian and I'm not married one, but my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law are both veterinarians in Ohio. And so I have never done a clinical rotation, but I remember that portion of my sister-in-law's life and just how she, you know, she went all around the country to different, you know, how valuable that was to her to be immersed in a different practice and a different experience and learn from veterinarians like yourself with, you know, long experience careers. And just kind of soak that all in, things that aren't necessarily, obviously the technical things that you learn in the classroom, but also just the non-technical things of being in a veterinary practice every day in and out and those kind of things. And she's spoken to me about like just the value of those clinical rotations for sure. And that's wonderful that you provide that opportunity for those students.
Yeah, and of course, the demographic of the average vet student has changed over the decades. You know, if you go back to, you know, when the Western College of Veterinary Medicine was started, in, I guess it was about 1966, and it was put in Western Canada to service the livestock industry. But back then, the vast majority of the students were guys from the farm. And of course, mm-hmm. that's changed substantially for a number of reasons. One of the reasons, of course, is just the explosive growth of small animal practices, definitely, you know, fueled even rural practices. So we have more students coming that don't necessarily have a farming background. So that's why the clinical side, you know, is really important to them, just to get out and get experience working directly with producers and cattle. It's probably more important today than it's ever been. And also because, you know, in the earlier days gone by, you could get a job as a summer student, you know, after your third year. And if you were in a, you know, a one or two man practice in rural Western Canada, they let you do quite a bit of stuff. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you know, of course, with the rules around, you know, veterinary care, it's highly structured and highly restricted. So that's basically, when you're a student, you're only going to get to do things under direct supervision, you know, fairly limited at that. So yeah, the clinical side has become quite important for the students.
As someone who their career goal is to just be a small, when I say just be a small, I don't mean that that's a lesser vet. I mean, they just want to focus on small animals. Does a small animal veterinarian still have to come and do a beef cattle clinical rotation so that they have that experience in their career?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that goes back to the whole concept we refer to as streaming. So, you know, if you look at the engineers, of course, they finish 1 year. Most of them would finish 1 year of general engineering and then stream it to civil or electrical or mechanical. The veterinary profession has never done that. There's definitely more flexibility now, where in your fourth year, you can pick rotations that suit your interest. But the profession has always felt that they want still to give you that broad base. And partly because if you ever, let's say, for example, you were interested in food production and cattle, and you were to get injured somewhere in that career and you couldn't do that anymore, and you decide you still want to practice, could you return to small animal practice, right? So if you've never done any and you didn't do any, and you know, through your, you didn't take those rotations, it's going to be a steep hill to climb to get up to speed. So the profession has always felt we're better served having a more, at least the first few years, a general education. And then in that, you know, in that clinical year, they do give them opportunities to select whether it's small animal, swine, cattle, feedlot production, whatever. So there is definitely a much more flexibility today than there used to be, but not 100% where you get to pick and do nothing but. And you're going to end up, you're going to end up doing some small animal surgery, and you're going to also end up doing some food animal rotations.
Right. Oh, I mean, that's probably beneficial all around. You know, you want your, I want my veterinarian, our veterinarian that we use, you know, for daily calls is, it's a all animal practice. And so I know that we can rely on them to help us, whether it be with our dogs or our cat or our cattle. So that, you know, that's reassuring. Since we're kind of on the topic of veterinary education, you've mentioned a few things that have changed over the years, but, you know, broader scope, how has veterinary education changed from the beginning of your career when you were a veterinary student to becoming a veterinarian and open your own practice? And then now that you teach veterinarian students, like, how is that, or have there been some really stark changes throughout that time?
Yeah, for sure. That's the one for, you know, certainly there's more clinical exposure now. So when I was in my last year of vet school, that was when they still had clinic, you still took classes at the same time you were doing rotations. Now virtually every vet school has gone away from that model. So they'll actually, the fourth year is all clinical rotations. So they'll be moving from one practice to another. Some of that may occur in the vet school itself, but there's no, they're done their sort of, you know, if you want to refer to it as book learning at the end of third year in your exams, most of that'll have been done already. And so fourth year is, you know, strictly devoted to clinical rotations. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that's happened too, of course, is there's been a change in the demographic, and it's been good. Like if you look back at my class, so the Western College, there were 76 students, and I think 44 females and 24 males. And so it was around 1982, I think, that we sort of passed the 50-50 mark where there was more females than males. And of course, over the last 20, 30 years, that's increased. So now most classes, and this isn't just Western Canada, this is North America and even in Europe as well, Australia, where the classes tend to be closer to 80 to 90% female. And then, which is great, it's been really good for our profession. But of course, that shifting demographic has sort of changed a little bit of for our labor requirements, because understandably, there's, you know, they do take some time off to have families, and that's wonderful. So, but I think, you know, when I was a new grad, there might have been maybe what we'd say 1.2 full-time equivalents, you know, so 1.2 veterinarians per job. Now, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's like 1.8. So that means, you know, there's a lot of people job sharing, and which is good. But of course, what's happened is two things happened. There's more job sharing, but there's also been an explosive growth of small animal care. And so that's how, you know, I'm sure you've heard about the shortage of veterinarians, and this discussion's been going on for 20 years. And I think what happened is that the veterinary colleges it was hard to anticipate where this was going. And so we did get into a shortage. But if you look at it now, I mean, in Canada, there's five vet schools. Four of them are in the process of increasing enrollment. Six vet schools, I'm sorry. In the U.S., they're building a number of schools. They're increasing enrollment at a number. Same thing in Europe. So we're really scrambling to try to fill that gap. I do worry a little that we might overshoot the mark because, you know, as you've noticed in my earlier bio, I'm part of another group that owns some other vet practices. And it's probably been in the last, I'd say one year that we're starting to be able to hire veterinarians a little easier. It's not easy, but it's easier. So we're starting to see some availability now. And that's partly due, there's lots of foreign graduates who've come to Canada as well. So there's been a very multi-pronged approach to try to address the vet shortage, from, you know, increasing enrollment, more foreign grads, that sort of thing. So I worry a little that we might overshoot the mark, and it's at a time when the cost of veterinary education is higher than it's ever been and continuing to go up.
Right.
And so I do worry that, you know, in the, you know, let's say in 6 to 8 years or so, when some of these vet schools are now finished and they're graduating students, that there's still a strong market for them if they're able to pay that debt back.
We have, you mentioned the veterinary shortage. I'm not familiar with, we don't visit the vet very often for small animal needs. Most of ours are for cattle or horses. But I know, I mean, here in rural Kansas, you know, the shortage of rural veterinarians is very real. And I fortunately live at the end of the more populated end of the state. I live in eastern Kansas, so there's definitely more people, so more veterinarians on this end. But I wouldn't say that there's just an excessive amount of them, right? And I know at the western end of the state, where there's, you know, city towns are more spread out and things like that, I know that it's just, it's harder to find people. And that's not even harder than a rural veterinarian, it seems like. More specifically, this is a little bit of a tangent, it's like it's hard to find an equine veterinarian as well down here. So the one equine veterinarian that lives near me, that he mostly specializes in horses, I mean, it's very hard to get into his appointment book if you need something. So that shortage just felt, you know, on a normal basis for people, I feel like. So I'm glad to hear that schools and the education system are addressing that and building it. But I can see how there's a lot of concern that if you build too many schools and you graduate too many people, then you have 2.1, you know, veterinarians per job role or something like that. So, and I had never heard those numbers before. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, of course, there's always this big time lag, right? From the time the idea of a vet school to actually building one, graduating the classes. So if you look at sort of where we're at today, I would, you know, the University of Saskatchewan wants to go from roughly 80 to 120. University of Calgary plans to double next fall. So they're going from 50 to 100.
Wow.
So, you know, in 4 years, we're going to be starting in Western Canada, graduating quite a few more veterinarians. So yeah, I hope, you know, but again, the profession is growing, and there are people who've done projections looking at this, and it, they feel that we're okay, that the demand will continue to grow. So, I guess hopefully it all works out, and, you know, that there's we strike the right balance where people can hire, as, you know, that's going to be the key for some of these practices, you know, and certainly practice people who are wanting to retire and looking for others, you know, veterinarians who want to be owners down the road and all that. So, I think, you know, we will reach that point, and hopefully it's in balance when we do.
Question about the 1.8 number. Are those position openings, are those inclusive of teaching positions? Or is that just strictly positions like for a practicing veterinarian? Or does that include anywhere, like even in industry, like an opening with a Cargill or an ABS or something like that? Are those positions all encompassing that number is, or is it just like practicing, like in a practice like yourself?
Good question. You know, I have to reflect on where that data came from, but I think it's sort of more industry-wide. And your point is a good one as well, that if you look at pharmaceutical companies, they hire a lot more veterinarians today than they once did too, because, mm-hmm. you know, the pharmaceutical industry, certainly on the cattle side, it's become more complex. You know, things like a lot of the beta agonist products and the implant products, you know, they're just more complex to use. And so there's more veterinarians that play a role at, you know, helping deliver how to use those products. So there's more veterinarians there. If you even think about universities, any university now that would be doing, you know, experiments using lab animals, almost all of them now would have a veterinarian on staff so he can care for the lab animal colonies. That wasn't necessarily the case 30, 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think veterinarians have found their ways into other niches, and that is that takes up some of them as well.
Yeah, those are not facets that I would have thought about, I mean, had you not mentioned them. I mean, like I said, I'm not a veterinarian and I don't work in the pharmaceutical industry. So there's a large number of people that go into that. And so I thank you for kind of addressing that question. I want to pivot a little bit because you touched on this earlier. You manage your business, you're practicing, you're teaching, but you also mentioned research and that you do a lot of research in your practice. So do you have any research that you want to share with us, or, you know, something that you're really excited about, a project that you're working on? You know, love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So there's lots of research going on. And what I've learned over time is that I've always made the comment that I'm not the smartest one in the room, but I usually can figure out who is. And so we've been very fortunate in our practice to align ourselves with really good people. And they come from the university environment. They come from the government environment. What I have failed to mention is my brother is also a veterinarian, and he teaches at college in Saskatoon. So we've done lots of projects with him, but, you know, currently we have a couple of three interesting things going on. One of the projects we're working with University of Saskatchewan and the University of Regina is a technology called probe capture. And it's a little bit like PCR, but it allows you to sort of look and find things that you don't know are there. So, you know, one of the challenges we've had, if you look at, you know, beef cattle practice, feedlot specifically, where, you know, our morbidity mortality has actually gotten worse over the last 20 years. It kind of keeps creeping up in spite of, you know, better vaccines, better antimicrobials, a better understanding of the epidemiology. And we're all puzzled by that. So we're kind of continually looking to see, is there something we're missing? And so the probe capture, so what we've done is we've swapped lots of cattle on arrival, and then we'll swab them interims in the feeding period and take water samples, and then running that through the probe capture, looking to find, is there some pathogens there that maybe contribute, not directly, but maybe synergistically work with existing pathogens? You know, is there other things, is there things that we've missed? To guess is that that's kind of what we're looking at there. So probe capture is one of the things we're looking at. Another thing we're doing is, one of the things we really encourage is, and this is more on the cow-calf side, is feed analysis, and just so that you're balancing your rations properly. And, of course, the traditional way is core your samples or take your samples, send them to the lab, have either NIR or wet chemistry done on them. There's a technology called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. And what it does is you hit this sample with a laser beam. And the nice thing about that is that it can give you not just sort of the constituents of the, you know, the cell wall part components, the, you know, the energy, the calculations, the protein and so on, but can also do both macro and micro minerals. And so that technology is out there, but it's, you know, it's something that doesn't, you know, it occurs in a lab under pretty careful conditions, and the equipment is expensive. We're working with the National Research Council out of Saskatoon on this, and they have a plasma chemist and some plant biologists, physiologists. And so what we're looking at trying to do is develop this, first of all, calibrate it so that we can actually do feed testing, but then over time, try to look at ways to miniaturize it. Because, you know, it's interesting now in the veterinary space, there's a company that's marketing an ultrasound machine that's basically fits in the palm of your hand and plugs into your cell phone. And you can use that to scan the lungs of, you know, so it's used in a feedlot setting where they can, you know, scan the lung and look for lesions and help determine whether the animal wants treatment or not. So, you know, when I think back about, you know, an ultrasound machine, when I graduated from vet school, there was one at the vet school, but there was no such thing in private practice. And the first ones were huge and they didn't give very good images. And now, you know, we have four of them that we use for pregnancy testing all the time. And, you know, they're not much bigger than, you know, but, you know, they fit in the palm of your hand as well. So a lot of this technology is getting better and smaller. And we hope someday down the road, much like what's happened with this ultrasound, that we'll get this laser spectroscopy technology to the point, not necessarily in your palm, but something you could take to the farm and, you know, get your analysis done in real time and then balance, you know, so that would allow you to balance rations much more quickly. And I think we'd get much better adoption of feed analysis and ration balancing if we could do that real time. And so the third thing, I guess, that we're doing a little bit, again, it goes back to the feedlot. And one of the challenges we've always had is, you know, pen checking in feedlots, we always call that an art. And if you've been around cattle, you'd well know that. And finding people that sort of still have that art, that come from farming backgrounds or cattle backgrounds, that can identify sick cattle, there certainly is a teachable thing. But if you can come from a background where you've had experience, it's much better. And so one of the things we've always tried to do, though, is how do we best determine if those cattle that are pulled, which ones warrant therapy? Because, you know, traditionally the way we do it is we pull cattle that look to be sick, and then we use a temperature cutoff and maybe some clinical signs, and then that becomes our criteria for a case definition of whether they get treated. And so I think, you know, they're just the pressure on us to use antimicrobials more judiciously, and then the value of cattle today too. So I think we're trying to get, you know, so that what we're working with is a company out of the University of Alberta that is able to do some sort of real-time shoot site analysis of what we call acute phase proteins. So those are proteins that are produced by the liver or sometimes by other cells in the body that are activated when there's infection. And so we're looking at using haptoglobin, which is a protein from the liver, but using it as a marker for respiratory disease and trying to do that real-time shoot side. And so, you know, we're just getting into that study now. We've got data on about 450 or 500 head, and we're just in the process of going back and correlating the haptoglobin back to the clinical outcomes, and just to see whether, you know, how that works and whether that could be used as, because we've always felt we needed something more than just temperature and the clinical impression. So those are three things we're currently working on. Then we're always involved with some sort of ongoing monitoring of antimicrobial stuff, just swabbing. There's a funding agency that has for a number of years has given out grant money to just sort of do monitoring of antimicrobial resistance in the feedlot. So throughout the year, we do some periodically sampling of that and submitting that just to kind of as a baseline.
That's certainly a worthwhile endeavor, watching that and managing that.
Yeah, I've always said there's two things that will not go away in my career or anybody who's coming into the veterinary profession in the future, and that's animal welfare and antimicrobial resistance issues. Those are here to stay with us, so we're going to have to keep working on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. I mean, speaking of challenges, I guess, because those are challenges, you know, that are not going to go away. Well, in your opinion, you've been working with beef producers, you know, your entire career, and you've been in the beef industry as a veterinarian. What are maybe some of the biggest challenges to the beef industry right now, moving forward, perhaps?
Well, as I speak today, of course, there's some concerns about tariffs. Of course,
yes.
With your new administration, there's been some discussion about tariffs on Canada. So that's got people concerned, just kind of wondering how that will all shake out. But I think just as a general statement, the cattle industry, I mean, right now it's incredible how, you know, with the prices, you're at record prices, as are we. But the volatility that, you know, we see today versus many years ago, I think it just seems to me it's a lot more unpredictable than it once was. But the good news is, of course, I think over time there's increasing demand worldwide for beef. So I think it bodes well for countries that do export. And you know, I think these trade issues, they always do seem to get resolved. But I would say right now the single biggest one for us would be just resolving any potential trade issues.
As I was saying that, I thought I have a feeling this is what the topic will be is trade, because that's certainly, it's of utmost importance. I have conversations online with people all the time explaining the importance of a mutually beneficial export and import agreements with people. Like it doesn't matter if it's us or if it's Canada. Like if you want to export products, you also have to be import those things. That's what global trade is. And so I agree with you. It's kind of causing some trepidation right now, particularly in the beef industry. But, you know, I appreciate your optimism that it will get worked out for sure.
It's time for our famous three.
A high-functioning rumen drives herd performance, gut health, and profitability. Levucel SC by Lelemon Animal Nutrition is the only naturally occurring rumen-specific active dry yeast probiotic designed to optimize rumen function, boost fiber digestion, and help you get more out of your native rangeland or pasture. No matter how you supplement your herd, include Levucel SC to help your cows grow bigger calves. Discover the right formulation for your herd at ChooseLevucelSC.com.
For our listeners who have been here for a while, we have reached the point of our episode where we ask our guests the same questions that we do of every guest. So I gave Dr. Jelinski a head up on these so that I'm not just springing them on him last minute. But Dr. Jelinski, what is your favorite beef or cattle-related resource? And I say resource because it could be a book or a website or a pamphlet. I have had probably my favorite answer was when we had a guest who said that his wife was his favorite resource because she handled like the genetics and things of the herd and he handled like the data analysis and stuff. So your favorite beef or cattle related resource?
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have such good relationships with so many people in the industry across, you know, academia and, you know, cattle feeders, beef producers. So they're all great resources. But I think if I'm looking sort of at it from a scientific point of view, Beef Cattle Research Council, which is an arm of the Canadian Cattlemen's Association, is very active on the research side, and they grant many grants each year going to multiple areas in the industry, and then they release that information as it becomes available. So I would say Beef Cattle Research Council, they would be a really good go-to for most of the things we want to stay current on.
You are not the first person to say that to BRSC, BCRS, I think. No, I said that bad.
BCRC.
Yes, BCRC. You're not the first person to give that answer. So it is a widely accepted, valuable resource to have. So
I am a little biased there too, because I have sat on their research review committee for many years. So I do get to see sort of the projects that come through, and it's great. They get a really nice cross-section of applicants.
All right. So moving on from the beef side of it, let's change tack. And what is your favorite non-beef or cattle-related book or one that you're currently reading?
Yeah. So I tend not to read much fiction. I guess when I read, I always kind of want to learn something from it. So at Christmas time, I did get a few books for Christmas. I did read actually Malcolm Gladwell. I do sort of enjoy his books. And his newest one is Revenge of the Tipping Point.
Oh.
So he goes back to some of the early parts that, you know, A Tipping Point was one of his earliest books. And so he reflects on that and sort of expands a little bit about how the tipping point influences things. And he gets into it a little deeper now as he's had years to reflect on that concept. So that was kind of an interesting book. I've got another book that my family gave me on energy and civilization. So it's really it's kind of A to Z about humanity and energy consumption, going back to prehistoric times to where we are today and how energy has sort of driven our development forward as far back as, you know, being able to go from hunter-gatherers to, you know, farming societies and then on to the point where we started burning fuels and so on. So it's quite interesting. And then I guess what's the other one? Some of the other books I've read recently. I guess those are two of the main ones. Yeah. That I've got on the go or have on. Read recently.
I'm a nonfiction reader also. I really like nonfiction. I want to learn. I mean, I feel like I learn things when I read fiction, but I feel like, I don't know. I just appreciate nonfiction as well. So we have that in common. Okay. And then our last kind of rapid fire question is, when you think of someone you admire or look up to, what is a characteristic they possess that has led them to be successful?
I think tenacity. Certainly some of the people and I'm thinking specifically people in the beef industry. Again, one of my mentors, his comment was, well, if you spend too much time looking at the deal behind you, you'll miss the one right in front of your face. And if we don't keep looking forward and kind of powering through some of these things, we'd want to just throw in the towel. So I do admire, and that's pretty much almost a general statement of people in the beef industry anyway, is it does take a fair amount of commitment and tenacity because there are new challenges. I mean, even if you think about the meat industry and potentially, you know, either lab grown meats or some of the, you know, plant-based meats, you know, what sort of potential impact can they have down the road? And, you know, so there's always sort of things popping up that can become obstacles. And I think just, knowing what your goals are and seeing the future and just staying focused on that. So tenacity would be, a characteristic that I would be quite admirable of.
I think that's that's wonderful. I agree. You have to have a certain amount of drive and tenacity to put up with the challenges that happen, because it's not an easy industry to weather. It's interesting you bring up the lab, you know, like the cultured meat. For our audience, we're recording this episode at the end of January, and just about a week ago, a state senator in Nebraska introduced legislation to prohibit the manufacturing, distribution, or sale of cultured meat products in the state. And it's under the Pure Food Act, which was from like 1906 in the United States, because of the book, Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle. So that's the history fact for the day The Jungle prompted the Pure Food Act, which laid the foundation for the United States Food and Drug Administration. So that's something I learned yesterday. But it's just interesting that there's this legislative action being taken against, you know, lab meat or cultured cell meat, you know, whatever phrase you use to address it. And that does take, it does challenge the industry, and you have to stick with it and address those challenges head on to kind of preserve, you know, the agriculture industry as we know it. So very, very interesting. And I haven't read that book.
I think there's several states that are actually implementing bans on the production of lab grown meat. So they will have their challenges as well.
Yeah. There were four last year that attempted it, Alabama, Arizona, Tennessee, and Florida. And Alabama and Florida they successfully passed that legislation into law. And I don't know what happened in Arizona and Tennessee that it didn't happen. I don't know if it didn't get out of committee or whatever, but I know that Alabama and Florida did make it happen. In Alabama, it's like a class, I don't know what class it is, but it's a misdemeanor with like a fine and such. So very interesting things happening indeed. So, well, thank you for those questions and those answers. I always love hearing what other people are reading and learning about. I have a Google Doc that has the books of all of my guests of like what they're reading. And I like going through that. And when I finish a book, I'm like, oh, what could I read next? So I hadn't heard that new Malcolm Gladwell book. I'll have to check that one out because I do like him as well. That is all the questions that I have for you today. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom and your experience and just your insight on so many different topics in the beef industry on the podcast today. If listeners have questions for you or want to learn more about our discussion today, where can they do that?
Yeah, I'm always interested in visiting with people on different topics. So they could reach me at my office email. So that's mikej@vahs.net. mikej@vahs.net.
Thank you again, Dr. Linsky, for your time. We greatly appreciate it. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in, and we'll meet you back here next week on the Beef Podcast.
Thanks, Brandy.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.